In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby.
Yeah, that's right.
Let's all go to the lobby.
Alan Adams here with us to talk movies now. Look, we love having Alan here just to talk, just to hang out with, but of late, it really has been a bountiful harvest for us. We had the pepper jelly a couple weeks back, which was amazing. And today, Alan, you've brought us salsa verde.
Yeah. We did Taco Sunday last night, like you do. And Sheridan roasted a bunch of vegetables from our wonderful farm share, courtesy of the folks at Nutty Fox Farm. So we got some green tomatoes, some tomatillos, roasted garlic, some jalapeno, a little lime juice, all whipped up. And it's good stuff, man. Like we had some with our tacos last night. And here's the thing about salsa verde. It just gets better. It just gets better the longer it sits. Yeah. So you guys enjoy that, because I think you're going to have a good time.
Well, we will. Thanks to you. Thanks to Sheridan.
Yeah, well, I will pass it along. She's listening right now.
Fantastic.
Hello, honey.
Hello. thanks, Sheridan. We miss you. And Stella. You saw a couple of movies this week. Only two this week, but that means we can dig a little deeper, dive deep. And I don't know what we're going to start with, but Carrie, I think, is planning to go see Dune maybe as soon as tomorrow. So he's very eager to hear what you think of that.
Yeah, I think what we'll do is we'll talk about the other one, kind of get that out of the way. And then we'll spend some time with Dune, because, again, I have a lot of things.
Oh, good.
We will have a very enthusiastic conversation about Dune here.
Yeah, excellent. All right. Well, I'm interested to hear about this animated film, because the previews look really interesting.
You know, it's one of those things where, I think we've talked about this in the past. I feel like the general quality of animated fare has gone up exponentially in the past decade or so. It used to be that it was like, okay, you know, you knew Disney and Pixar, they were gonna bring their A game. But after that, there seemed like it was a little bit of a drop off, and sometimes you would get stuff that felt a little janky, a little a little stitched together, a little simplistic, maybe, you know, almost condescending to younger audiences. But, you know, in the 10, 15 years, like, I feel like there's been a significant uptick in the general quality of these sorts of movies. And this is a perfect example. So it's called Ron's Gone Wrong. It's from 20th Century Productions. It is the first animated release from that newly dubbed wing of the Disney Corporation. This was a Fox Animation joint, but the acquisition that took place over, this is the first one of their products that has been released under this banner. And it's a perfectly nice animated sort of family film. It's got some good jokes. It's got a great voice cast. It looks good. A little bit of that CGI sheen, but there's not a lot. That's fine. That's what it is. And pretty good messaging as far as that goes. Although they kind of stumble a little bit when it comes to sticking the landing with regards to their message. But for the most part, I think it's really nice. It basically revolves around this kid named Barney, voiced by Jack Dylan Grazer. Lives with his widowed dad, voiced by Ed Helms, and his insane Polish grandmother, Danka, voiced by Rich. I didn't know this until, like, I didn't even notice it when I was watching the movie. The Polish grandmother, voiced by Olivia Colman.
Whoa.
Oscar winner Olivia Colman.
Fantastic.
Is chasing chickens around this suburban kitchen with a meat cleaver. It's just like, you know what? That is a woman who's living her best life.
Oh,
like,
yes,
not to get off track here, but, man, yeah, go Olivia Colman. So it's set in some sort of nebulous near future, where there's a ubiquitous tech company known as Bubble that has announced this new product they call the Bebot. And the Bebot is essentially it's basically a robot friend. It hooks up to the internet, examines your entire online life, your likes, your dislikes, and incorporates that into its own sort of personality, filtered through the the friend algorithm invented by Bubble's CEO. And so it rapidly becomes ubiquitous, like these new technologies always do, and the kids are really embracing them. But poor Barney, his family can't afford a Bebot, and so he's sort of finds himself a little bit isolated. He was always kind of the weird kid, but now there's this extra layer of isolation, an issue that his distracted father finally notices, and makes his way to the Bubble headquarters in an effort to get one of these robots, only they can't afford it, and there's a three-month wait. And then he winds up buying one that both literally and figuratively fell off the back of a truck and gives that to Barney. Barney starts it up, and it is clearly broken. Like, there's it can't connect to the internet, and it can't, enact all the various protocols, algorithmic or otherwise, voiced by Zach Galifianakis. just by the way.
Fantastic.
And so Barney initially wants to take him back, but then decides, you know what? I'm just going to teach you how to be my friend instead of asking the internet to do it. And then their relationship sort of burgeons because, you know, Barney's a weird kid. We find out the robot's name is Ron. Ron's a weird robot, and it's a match made in heaven. But as often happens in these situations, the nail that sticks up gets hammered down, and when Bubble finds out that Ron is not obeying his standard programming, it sets in motion a number of events that affect people on both a small and large scale. And I'm not going to spoil anything else beyond that, but it's cute. Like the gags are pretty good. Some nice action sequences. I laughed a couple of times. Being a soft touch, also got a little dusty a couple times. The underlying message in that, this idea that kids should try to connect with one another as opposed to doing so through a screen or some sort of device, to do it directly, I think is a valuable message to be presented, talking down talking about some of the dangers of the ubiquity of technology. Honestly, I think the biggest issue with this movie is it's not quite as good as The Mitchells versus the Machines, which came out earlier this year and addressed a lot of the same themes. Although I think this is aimed at a younger audience and is very successful in those terms. Although when I say that, it's going to be perfectly enjoyable for grownups to watch as well. So yeah, like I didn't have particularly high expectations, but I went in and I really had a good time. So yeah, Ron's Gone Wrong. Get some stuff right.
Excellent. All right. Let's talk Dune.
Okay, so I struggled with how I was going to write a review of Dune for a number of reasons. First of all, it is, as the title card tells you, although it does not tell you that in the actual title, this is part one of a two-part exploration of the first of in Frank Herbert's Dune series of novels. Now, Dune came out in 1965, I think, and is this... frankly, very intellectual, philosophically dense, eco-conscious exploration of, giving value to people who weren't necessarily, as valued in that, in his time and place, whether we're talking about women who have a great deal of power in this story, or even other cultures. The Dune has been referred to as a very Islamophilic book, as opposed to Islamophobic, like very celebratory of desert cultures in general, which I think is great. But when you're dealing with a book like this that is so built around interiority, like so much of the story is told through the thoughts of the characters that we're experiencing, not least because there are a number of mind readers and who speak secret unspoken languages with one another in the book. As you might imagine, portraying mind reading and unspoken languages in a movie presents some obstacles. All that being said, I'm going to sit right here and I'm going to tell you that Denis Villeneuve is a genius. He is a straight up cinematic genius. He is a brilliant auteur whose visual sensibility is both bold and idiosyncratic, and it is at its best when it is married with these sorts of grand science fictional worlds. We saw it with Blade Runner 2049, and we're seeing it with this movie, because it's so rare for me to be overwhelmed by a film. Like, it's not that, you know, it's not that I can't, you know, talk about it in terms of good and bad. Like, it's a very good movie. Not the best movie I've ever seen, but it's a very good movie. But it's a movie that really, it overwhelmed me both with the story being told and the way in which the story is told. Because you have these grand sweeping vistas. It's this space opera that's also built around... fathers and sons, and fathers and mothers and sons, and, you know, interpersonal relationships, both political, personal, what have you. Like, it's a very complicated sort of situation, and to bring that to life on screen in a way that is compelling to both those who are steeped in Dune. I love the first two books. I like the second three and the second one and one half books, and then you can kind of maybe walk away from the Frank Herbert series. I've read them all, but so I'm familiar with Dune and its sort of larger lore and mythos. But I can't say for certain, because I am that, but I also believe that anyone with zero knowledge of Dune or what Dune is can watch this movie and understand and grasp what's going on, which, again, and Carrie can tell you this, to be able to convey this story visually to people who've never read the book is I wasn't sure it could happen, because you know who couldn't do it? David Lynch.
Right.
And David Lynch is another brilliantly idiosyncratic cinematic genius who tackled this story. And you know, and I'm someone I'm a Dune apologist as far as Lynch is concerned. Like,
well, we were saying that earlier. We were fine with that version of it. It wasn't great. It had some flaws, but enjoyed it.
Yeah, no, I dug Lynch's Dune, I will say on it. It certainly, like, he certainly captures, I think, some of the real deep down weirdness of Dune a little bit better than Villeneuve does. But in terms of just sheer cinematic, like, experience, just like the pictures you're seeing on the screen, whether you're talking about, you know, these sort of massive noble houses. Okay, I'm going to stop for just a second. I'm not even going to try to synopsize Dune.
Good.
Yeah, we don't have a 24-hour show.
Right. Like, so. I mean, and that was one of the challenges for my review, because it's like one of the things I like to do is sort of give some sort of synopsizing of the story. And I did a little bit of that. But the reality is, it's like, it's almost better if you either know already, and if you don't know already, it's almost better if you go in cold and just sort of experience it and let it wash over you. I'm frankly a little jealous of people who get to do that, just because it is such a grand sort of story being told in a very nuanced way. Like, the way Villeneuve is able to sort of convey some of the subtler ideas that are built around, you know, these noble houses battling across the galaxy, and, you know, this idea that there's this one planet that provides this one material that basically makes their entire civilization possible. Yes, controlling that would make you incredibly powerful, and giving up that control would make you incredibly furious. And so, we've fought wars on this world for far less, you know? And so to sort of build to that sort of conflict, while also, you know, spinning out the various ideas behind these noble houses. You've got, you know, the purity of House Atreides with Duke Leto, played by Oscar Isaac, who's great, and, you know, his wife Lady Jessica, played by Rebecca Hall, who is an acolyte of the Bene Gesserit. Like I said, I'm not going to get into any of that. Like, if you honestly just go find a Dune primer if that's what you're looking for, because like Carrie said, we just don't have the time. And so these two have come together, and their son Paul, played by Timothy Chalamet, is sort of the central figure in this story. He's the one who is going to ascend to the heights of power, but we're not entirely sure which heights of power that he's going to ascend to, whether they are in the purely political realm, if they're in the mystical realm, or if it's some sort of amalgamation of the two. And that's one of the primary sort of, conflicts is the right word, but one of the primary sort of the central themes of the book, and hence the movie. Now, you know, you've got the Duke with his trusted aides, played by some wonderful performers, Josh Brolin, Jason Momoa, the delightfully named Duncan Idaho. Like, I saw a lot of people complaining on Twitter about, like, oh, why would you name him Duncan Idaho? It's like, you know, people have place names for last names all the time. Like, get over it. But then on the bad guy side, you've got the sort of evil Baron Harkonnen, who's the leader of House Harkonnen, who is, I think, one of the greatest villains in sci-fi literature. And he is... Stellan Skarsgård plays the part, and he is awesome.
He can do slimy.
Yeah, you know, and it's just like, and he's bald, and he's like bulky, and he's always like dripping with something and floating around. Just, oh, it's just so creepy. And, you know, he has this his sort of right-hand man, his nephew, played by Dave Bautista. So you have all these, you know, so you've got Brolin, Momoa, and Bautista all playing different flavors of Space Warrior in the ways that only they could do it. And it's just so delightful. I mentioned Chalamet. Like, he's perfect. He's perfect for this role of a young prince who is sort of, you know, not necessarily ready to lead, but like forced into a position where, like it or not, this is coming. You know, so we get, you know, we get maybe a little too much brooding from him early on. But as it develops, and he's so talented, so he can really sort of bring the subtle gradations of that development to life. Oscar Isaac is Oscar Isaac. Like, just put him in everything. Although, I mean, the last couple of months, it feels like he is in everything. Just the way things have all sort of stacked out. But yeah, like, man, tell you what, that dude's regal. Like, give him all the nobleman parts, because like, it's just like, you just buy it. Rebecca Hall is brilliantly talented, and she's wonderful. And it's just this dynamite cast. But again, I have to circle back to the sheer visual spectacle of this movie.
Did you see it in the theater, or did you watch
it
streaming?
I didn't. I watched it at home. I'm probably going to wind up going to see it in a theater. Just because I want to see it bigger.
Right.
But like, there was no question about the scale of what you're watching, even on a relatively small screen. It's not like my TV's tiny, you know what I mean? Like, it's, you know, Villeneuve has such wonderful knack of crafting these wonderful sort of wide panoramic shots where you really are forced to sort of almost a forced perspective. And so you have these massive landscapes with tiny, tiny individuals inside them, really dwarfed by their surroundings, in a way that is just compelling as hell to see. And, you know, he does a nice balance between the interpersonal back and forths and those grander sort of schemes. But whether you're talking about the architecture of these noble houses filled with, you know, these people in these elaborate costumes, or you're talking about these enormous spacecraft that people are coming in and out of, or you're talking about the windswept dunes of the desert planet Arrakis, or and we only see them a couple times, but man, Carrie, those sandworms, I'm not gonna lie, man, it's like, it just is one of those things where it's like, because I loved Lynch's take on them.
Yep.
And it's like, oh, it's basically like my feeling about it was, I feel the same way, but it just feels bigger. Like, it just, and it's like, and they're just, there's this sense of, you know, size, you know, and the sort of almost insignificance of the individual that he has such a wonderful knack of capturing, whether we're talking about this movie or something like Arrival, just this idea of being able to really sort of narrow that focus while also sort of expanding the background. It's something that not a lot of filmmakers can do. And I think it's an absolute key skill when it comes to rendering a story like this on film. So yeah, like, I mean, I've always written pretty hard for Villeneuve, but this is a really just, it's a remarkable achievement. And again, like I said, like it's one of those movies that almost transcends the sort of typical, oh, it was good because X, oh, I didn't like it because Y. Like, it's just, there's just so much, but it's so much rendered in such a palatable way that it's just like it's overwhelming, but not off-putting.
Now, about how much of the story is covered in part one without giving too much away?
They say half. It's probably a little bit more than that. Like, it's for those who are super familiar with the book, the button is probably makes sense to you. Like I said, it's probably a little past the halfway point, but it's solid as a part one. You know, if you want to argue that the ending is more of an ellipsis than a period, I'm not going to fight you on that. That's the reality. Whenever you take a single work and try to make, you know, multiple works out of it. I didn't have a problem with where it ended. I felt like it was a complete tale, unto itself. It was just a tale, instead of an ending, you got a new beginning. I think that's the way to look at it. And and I think it really worked. It just so beautiful, so stark, so just thoughtful and thought-provoking. And it was a remarkable experience, and one that I hope it looks like all systems are go for part two. I guess there was a little doubt about that, but you know, with the day and date release and all that stuff, but they did over 40 million at the box office this past weekend. So I think they're going to be okay. And we can just look forward to part two and see how things are going to play out.
Awesome. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing it. You are more or less excited now.
Oh, I try not to get any expectations for films I'm looking forward to. This is one of those films that I'm trying to just go in. I will be able to tell you what a non-Dune person's reaction is, because my wife is not familiar with it beyond just knowing that it's a science fiction thing that I've talked about before in the past.
Right.
I don't know that she's even ever seen the 1980s movie.
Yeah.
Which she wouldn't have liked, because I feel like that movie, you had to know Dune.
Yeah, I think
you just had to know.
I think that's a fair assessment. Aww. Well, because I mean, because Lynch did the whole thing in like 2 hours.
Yeah.
Like that's,
yeah,
you know, and you know, Villeneuve's going to wind up with probably 5 hours to play with when it's all said and done. So
yeah, I don't know if we'll make it this week, but it will be soon, and I'll be able to report back whether a non-Dune person enjoys it as much.
Yeah, I look forward to hearing what you think of it. I think you're gonna really dig it. I really do.
Awesome. Alan Adams talking movies with us here on Pass the Popcorn. Alan, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Thanks to you and Sheridan again for the salsa.
Of course.
And we'll see you Wednesday.
Yes, you will.
Woo, here we go.